But I'm Mark Collins, and this is Phil Carter. You are at Accountable Discipleship, and he's going to tell you all the cultured stuff, and then I'm going to tell you how to do it.
It's one way to put it. Great to be with you. My name is Phil Carter. I'm a pastor in the Indiana West Central District and at North Cornerstone Church in Linden, Indiana, just south of Lafayette. And I am currently also working on a Doctor of Ministry in Spiritual Formation at Wesley Seminary and doing my dissertation on class meetings. And so looking at an adaptive form of a class meeting for the Global Methodist Church. So looking at how do we take this old model and bring it into the new, into our culture today. And so some of what you're going to hear this morning comes from that research, and some of it is additional research to my real research, I guess. And then, like Art said, he's going to take it to the practical. But I wanted to survey a little bit on the theological and the historical. That's kind of my wheelhouse where I love to kind of sit. And part of this really for me has been a part of my personal quest to find an authentic Methodist pathway of discipleship. So we are a global Methodist church, and there's a DNA in that. There's an identity within that. And part of my personal journey has been searching for that DNA and trying to discover what it is that makes us Methodist. And to a large degree, I think this that we're covering today makes us Methodist. So we're going to be looking at discipleship groups as they developed in early Methodism and then translating that into our culture for where we are. So Accountable Discipleship, a Methodist framework. I want to start with our mission statement as the Global Methodist Church. And these first couple of slides, I promise I did not steal them from the bishop, although he presented this exact same material in his first talk on Wednesday. But I think it's worth noting here, the Global Methodist Church exists to make disciples of Jesus Christ and spread scriptural holiness across the globe. And I've often wondered, why do we have both of those, the making disciples of Jesus Christ and the spreading of scriptural holiness? The scriptural holiness really interprets the making of disciples. They're one and the same, essentially. And so when we are talking about accountable discipleship, I like to place this directly in scriptural holiness. Accountable discipleship is really about holiness. And so, of course, this mission statement comes from how the early American Methodists understood themselves in 1784 when we first organized. And that, of course, goes back to how the early English Methodists understood themselves back in 1763 in the Large Minutes. What may we reasonably believe to be God's design in raising up the preachers called Methodists? And the answer was to reform the nation, and in particular the church, to spread scriptural holiness over the land. Scriptural holiness. So from the very beginning, this is what we were all about. In fact, not just at the beginning, but all across Wesley's lifetime, this has been the theme. You see, this is a letter that Wesley wrote in the last year of his life. He died in March of 1791, and this was written in September of 1790, to a Robert Carr Brackenbury. And he's talking about full sanctification, and he says that this is the doctrine that is the grand depositum which God has lodged with the people called Methodists. And for the sake of propagating this, chiefly he appeared to have raised us up. And I think in our new movement of the Global Methodist Church today, we still have that same calling. God, I think, has raised us up for this specific purpose to reclaim this heritage from our Methodist tradition. And so when we're talking about accountable discipleship, ultimately it stems from and aims toward the scriptural holiness. So my favorite quote from John Wesley comes from his sermon on the scripture way of salvation. And where he gives us this picture of salvation, which is much bigger than mere conversion, right? He says, ye have been saved, quoting there from Ephesians chapter 2. He says, ye have been saved so that the salvation which is here spoken of might be extended to the entire work of God from the first dawning of grace in the soul until it is consummated in glory. I love this because, number one, it shows us that salvation is not our work. It's God's work. It's a work of grace. And it stretches from that first dawning of grace in the soul, prevenient grace, the initial awakenings to God's grace, all the way to the consummation of that grace and glory. Right? So as Methodists, we have big picture salvation. You could almost map it like this. So this is a chart I take from Dr. Chris Bounds, one of my former professors, a good friend of mine. And he maps it this way, showing God's grace filtering down, and you have our human response working up. So we are always responding and cooperating with God's grace, right? And the intent is to cooperate with God's grace in a positive direction so that you're growing in grace. And so you see from prevenient grace to justifying grace to sanctifying grace to glorifying grace, right? And all of this, we say, is salvation, right? The question then becomes, how does this happen? Where do we get this working out in our lives? Well, in the early Methodists, they saw this as social holiness. Salvation works itself out through social holiness. I have to pause because this is a term that has often been abused and misunderstood in recent decades in our tradition. What we mean by social holiness, what Wesley meant by social holiness, is not social justice. Certainly there is an aspect of reaching out and serving those among us, the least of these, and doing works of mercy and justice work as a part of this, but primarily Wesley used the term as communal formation. Communal formation, or the way in which we grow spiritually together. It's the environmental context in which holiness takes place. He only uses the term once in all his writings, in all his sermons, all his letters. He only uses it once. It's very early in the tradition. In 1739, in the preface to the Hymns and Sacred Poetry that he published with his brother Charles, he says, "The gospel of Christ knows of no religion but social, no holiness but social holiness." And if you look out and zoom out to the context of that, he's really contrasting social holiness with the idea of solitary holiness. There's no such thing as holy solitaries, he says. We cannot do the Christian life by ourselves in isolation. We need one another. And so this is what we're getting at when we talk about social holiness.
Can I ask a quick question here?
Sure.
I mean, I certainly agree this is a key component to who Wesley was, what he preached and taught. This concept of social holiness, but this is news to me that he only really publicly said this one time.
Yeah.
So how did it become such a key component to who and what he was, given the paucity of physically talking about it?
It's a very good question. A lot of it has to do with, I think, the last several decades in the mainline tradition that gravitated toward the progressive understanding of social justice. And in fact, I'll show you on the next slide, there's this quote from Andrew Thompson, which I've pulled out of an essay that he wrote in the Methodist Review, where he traces that history. And he describes how it really became popular in the social justice sense in the 1960s and 70s. Yeah, but what he's doing in this essay is to help us reclaim what Wesley understood and what the early Methodists understood by the term.
Well, thank God for Andrew Thompson.
Yeah.
I'm with you, we got abused.
Yeah, so he's a Methodist pastor out in Oklahoma. I'm hoping that his church will eventually join us, but they've left the UMC, but have not quite joined us.
Harry Emerson Fosdick and the social gospel,
yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
Right. So he says, this is Andrew Thompson, Wesley's sense of social holiness is of a certain reality of graced fellowship, where men and women come to a fuller knowledge of God and Christ together via the change effected when grace is actively received. So social holiness, that graced fellowship, right? Again, going back to the salvation picture that we had up there, all that big picture salvation happens in community with each other, that we do not walk that road by ourselves. And so how did the early Methodists do this? Well, being Methodists, they developed a method. And it really fell into three primary tiers. There were other sub-tiers as well, especially in the smaller group settings. But these are the three primary developments. And I just want to walk through this a little bit via historical approach. So the Methodist societies, for example, this is what you might say is the big group setting. This is the largest setting of the early Methodist. It developed alongside the Moravian influence. So John Wesley, he was an Anglican priest. He went off to Georgia as a missionary here in America. He had a terrible experience there, as you might know. He came back to London in 1738. He had an Aldersgate experience, and he's joining with the Fetter Lane Society in 1738 alongside the Moravians. Eventually, they had a falling out over issues of quietism, where the Moravian influence wanted to disregard the means of grace and said that we could become holy just by sitting in a dark room by ourselves, right? And they ignored the means of grace. And Wesley, being an Anglican, had a great value for the means of grace. And so he separates from them, and he goes off to Bristol in 1739, and he starts the New Room Society over there. And then eventually other societies develop. That's the big, large-scale grouping of the Methodists. Then jumping down to the band meetings developed alongside the societies. These band meetings were smaller groups of about 3 to 5 people, same gender, same marital status, and they would meet together for more intense accountability. So they were a subgrouping of the Methodist society, but they were more focused in their intent. For a while, the class meeting did not exist. It was just the societies and just the bands. But eventually, the class meetings developed, and it's interesting how it developed. In 1742, they were sitting around a table, Wesley and his leaders, trying to figure out how are we going to pay down the debt on the New Room meeting house. And one gentleman, Captain Foy, he said, well, how about we go, we divide our society into classes of about 12 people. We could do it by neighborhoods, by regions. And we assign leaders to those classes, and they can go house to house to collect a penny every week from every member, and eventually we'll pay down the debt. Well, they started doing that, and as the class leaders went out to the houses, they discovered that some people were not living a godly life. They were not living the Christian lifestyle, right? And this comes back to Wesley, and he begins to reimagine the class as an opportunity for spiritual formation, for pastoral guidance. And besides that, it would also be more convenient if all the members of the class would come together to a central meeting place and bring their money for the collection as well. And so as they come together and they start meeting, this group of 12 people, mixed gender, mixed marital status, just whoever was in that region assigned to that class, they would come together and they'd meet for spiritual conversation. If I could go back to the band meetings just a little bit, because I want to differentiate band meetings from class meetings. Band meetings, they met for intense discipleship and accountability, and they asked 5 questions primarily. Number one, what known sins have you committed since our last meeting? What temptations have you been met with? How were you delivered? What have you thought, said, or done, of which you doubt whether it be sin or not? Have you nothing you desire to keep secret? So imagine coming to a group like that, and you have to reveal all the things that you did wrong that week. A very intense accountability discipleship group. And again, that...
Were the bands smaller than classes?
Yes. Yeah. So again, those were about 3 to 5 people, and they were of the same gender, and they were of the same marital status. So you have just all single people or all married people. Yep. And then the class meeting, as it developed, it was filling a niche in between the society, the large scale gathering, and the bands, the small scale. So the class meeting was about 12 people, and again, mixed gender and mixed marital status. And they primarily met for 3 reasons. I've left off the third because that's not quite as relevant to us. It's the collection of the money. Which you could do in your class meeting, I mean, if you wanted. But the spiritual purpose was primarily to inquire how their souls prosper and to advise, reprove, comfort, or exhort. And so that's still in our general rules in our Book of Doctrines and Discipline today. So this became a spiritual thing as they gathered together. These gatherings ultimately gathered for this general purpose, and this is how Wesley described these groups in total. He says that they were a company of men and also women, having the form and seeking the power of godliness, united in order to pray together, to receive the word of exhortation, and to watch over one another in love, that they may help each other to work out their salvation. And that's key, to watch over one another in love. There's a lovingness to this. And again, that final tag, to help each other work out their own salvation, right? Think of Paul's letter to the Philippians, working out your own salvation. But they're doing that together. They're spurring one another on to perfection. And so to go back to that big picture salvation, from the dawning of grace in the soul till it's consummated in glory, now that's happening in community with others. So that is a very brief overview of the history and the theology of why we have accountable discipleship and why we do it in this particular way, or why we recommend that this be done in this way. There are other models and things out there, but this, I think, helps us to recapture the DNA that is fundamental to us as the people called Methodists. I have a final slide here with some resources. Some of these are academic. Some of these are pretty accessible. But if you run across the name Watson, you're probably in the realm of discipleship, because there's Kevin Watson and there's David Lowe's Watson. David Lowe's Watson's the older. As far as I know, they're not related. But David Lowe's Watson has the early Methodist class meeting, its origins and significance. He has another model of covenant discipleship. And then Kevin Watson is more recent. And Art's going to mention the resources we have on the table as well that come from him. And he also has a recent history of Methodists in America and the Pan-Methodist movement, our whole family. So I appreciate his work. But Art is going to talk about the practical.
Thank you. Good stuff. Phil mentioned that he does, his interest is in his D-Men work in the history and development of this. I tell people I have an ornamental doctorate. It's not an honorary doctorate, but when I got it, no one cared, and I came back in the system the same level I left. You know, there's no promotions just because you're a PhD now. And it's not in divinity or ministry or whatever. My PhD is in curriculum and instruction. It's a teacher education degree. I teach people how to teach. I teach people how to design new programs and make them work and all that kind of stuff. I do, you know, I'm a full bore minister. I do all the rest of it too. But my interest in this stuff is to equip people to know how to make this stuff work. Because people read the books, go, oh, this is so cool, and then they try to do it, and it just grinds to a halt. They don't know how to put wheels under this thing. So that's my gig. This is my first slide, and Phil's already covered this. The bands came from the Moravians. The classes came out of typical Methodist thing. The bands came out of a problem to be solved, and then we made it spiritual. That's, you know, the classic history of Methodism is organizing to beat the devil. Emphasis as much on organizing as it is on beating the devil. So anyway, I want to talk about the accountable discipleship group, because there is no one thing that you can call the accountable discipleship group or the class meeting. There's no one approved product to say this is what you really need to do. There's a bunch of stuff out there. And what works for you or not work for you depends on your milieu and what your people will sit still for and so forth. But there are some consistent patterns. Number one, an accountable discipleship group has a different kind of leadership. The leader is not teaching a Bible study. The leader is not showing a video. The leader is not doing a program. The leader isn't supposed to come with something to entertain you. All that stuff that we think adult activities are about and the leader does stuff is absent. The class leader is there to keep the conversation on track. Period, full stop, end of story. Now that means sometimes you have to draw out the shy people. Sometimes it means you have to think but steer people away, and we all know them, who just love to talk about their interior life at length. This is your typical adult Sunday school class. You know, one or two people are just going on about the thing that they experience, and everyone else is, you know, waiting for the football game to start. Or whatever. So it's a guided conversation. And in a typical class meeting, as discussed in Kevin Watson's book, and we have copies back there, and the price is free, if you could afford that. Watson's book is an excellent thing to get people excited, but it's basically a sales pitch. It's really light on detail. What he's not telling you is that all the heavy lifting here is in the class leader, and the class leader has to know how to lead without performing. So guiding the conversation, keeping it on track, the typical Wesleyan class meeting either starts out with the general question, how does it prosper with your soul? Or you can say, what'd you do this week? How'd it go? You could go day by day, week by week. You could structure it on the three general rules. Have we all stayed away from all the harm this week? Have we all done some good stuff? Tell what you do to this week. Have we been faithful in the observing all the means of grace? And sometimes people come in and they got something that they just got to talk about. Okay, we can make room. You can have more than your usual allotted amount of time, but we want everyone to be involved. So if you've got like 12 people in a group, which is a pretty large, small group, and you're going to meet for an hour, and by the way, no meeting like this should go more than an hour. People should know they're not held hostage to however long this takes. So it's an hour. You got 12 people, you got an hour, do the math, 5 minutes apiece. Average. For some people, talking about themselves for 5 minutes is just crossing a desert without water. It's so painful. You have to be so kind and helpful. Other people, oh my God, they can burn 30 minutes telling you about what they had for breakfast. Okay, so the leader facilitates. He does not perform or teach. Now, mention the weekly class meeting where the heavy lifting is done by the class leader. There's no other structure. So you really got to work on developing the class leader. Now, there are other models. David Lowes Watson wrote this years ago called Covenant Discipleship. You can get this from Discipleship Resources. And there's a version for teenagers. There's a version for older elementary youth called Sprouts. It's the same stuff, but it's kind of rephrased so that kids can understand it. But Covenant Discipleship, as an update of the weekly class meeting, works in a peculiar way. You have to write a covenant. So let's say your church is going to start so many Covenant Discipleship groups, and everyone kind of does the sock hop and joins up this group, that group, whatever. You have a time limit. We're going to do this for 6 months, let's say. And at the end of 6 months, the group is dissolved, and you can start new groups. Join somebody else's group. Gives people a guilt-free opportunity if when life changes to not say, oh, they're counting on me and I have to do this forever. So the church as a whole is doing covenant discipleship, and the groups change all the time. You can always re-up with the same group. But covenant discipleship is built on the Jerusalem cross, which is four crosses within the quadrants of a big cross, which symbolizes this. We owe certain duties to God, and we owe certain duties to our neighbor. Certain duties are personal, direct, private. Certain duties are public, corporate, altogether. So, the things we do alone with God, direct with God, are called acts of devotion. The things we do together to fulfill our duty to God are acts of worship. The things we do directly, the kindnesses and help that we show to others, are acts of compassion. The things we do corporately to put people's lives and homes and so forth back together and build the community are acts of justice.
So you could have an infinite number in every category. But what the group has to do is they have to write a covenant. So they sit down and they negotiate with each other four or five things in each group. It's kind of like an exercise group. You know, I got to work on my pets, or I got to get lose some weight or whatever. And people decide what's most relevant to themselves. And you write this covenant for your group that everybody signed off on. Everyone has said every week we're going to do these, you know, 12 to 20 things. And so the reporting in the group for that 1 hour is you're going down the list and everyone's saying, yep, nope, didn't get that done this week. I'm sorry. And you can talk about difficulties in doing them and so forth. So the difficulty with this is it takes a lot to set up and to communicate the concept and get everybody on board. Once it's going, you have a high buy-in because people are fulfilling a covenant which is highly specific and concrete, and they helped write it, and they're committed to doing it. So it's a high initial lift, a heavy initial lift to get started. It has pretty good results on the other end. But that's his version of this. And then I forgot to bring my purple book. You all know what the purple book is? We all talk about the purple book. That's a little service book they give you on a walk to Emmaus or a crystal slide. No one knows the official name. It's just, you got your purple book? Okay. That has in it something called the order of the reunion, which they teach you on the last day, which is how to keep the experience alive, where you're supposed to have a small group. And the key parts of that are answering questions together, such as, where have you seen Christ this week? Where have you denied Christ this week? How have you heard God calling this week? And there's a couple of associated prayers, and this gives a form to the meeting. People know how it begins, how it continues, how it ends. And once again, the leader is drawing people out or helping to make sure everyone gets to express themselves. My personal conviction is that the reunion group, the Emmaus reunion group, is probably the easiest one to do, the most friendly in terms of telling you what to do, and the least effort to set up. If you've got a church that has a lot of Emmaus, Curcio, Chrysalis, Great Banquet people in it, this is probably your easiest one to get going, because they already know how to do this, and they know they're supposed to. And no one says you have to do, the official copyright patent-pending Kevin Watson way to do the accountable discipleship. Some of you may have been around long enough, you've got what they used to call them. I think they're still around, the men's group out of Colorado, the Promise Keepers. They were Promise Keepers groups for men. Same kind of concept. We're going to get together and we're going to talk about our lives and we're going to hold each other accountable for the walk that we're making. You don't have to do it the way anyone else does it, but you got to be careful that it doesn't wander off into something programmatic and it stays on that direct conversation where leaders are helping people clarify what their lives are about and what they're doing. Okay, let's talk about bands. Bands are for when you're ready. The closest, it's focused on confession and support, as Phil said. The closest analogy for most people is a 12-step recovery group. And you may never have been involved in a 12-step recovery group, and consider yourself fortunate and graced that you haven't had to be. I haven't been. I know how they work. You know, you go there and someone stands up and says, my name is Art Collins, and I'm a churchaholic, and this is my 15th meeting this week. Right? You know. But people who are recovering from drugs or alcohol or abusive situations or pornography or all kinds of stuff need the support of other people. And you go to one of these meetings, and you're just bloated with shame, and you're, you know, oppressed, and so forth. You may not even want to be there. And someone stands up and describes your life to you from their history. And that's a powerful thing. And you realize, oh, they know what this is about. And over time, you get to where you can say things about yourself you've never been able to say and admit to. And they're there, whatever it takes, to stand with you to help you not do that anymore. That's what a 12-step group is. In terms of sanctification, when you're desperate to kick the sin habit, when you've had enough, when you can't stand yourself anymore, when you're willing to be disgraced before others, if that's what it takes, you're ready for a band. Because these are the people who will say what they've done and are not shocked by anything you say. Now, people have this beautiful idea. We're going to join a band, and we're going to be so close and so tight, and we're going to love each other so much. That may be so, but that comes out of knowing things and being willing to share things that don't get to be made public knowledge. And some people can't handle that, and they say, man, I have made a terrible mistake. That's fine. You don't have to stay in that. But the band is for people who are yearning, desperately thirsting for entire sanctification. They want to kick the sin habit, finally get it over with, not do this anymore. They want to be clean. And if you're not that desperate yet, you don't need this. You can get along with what everyone else does, and that's fine. Okay, so supervising this is really important. I mentioned covenant discipleship automatically has a cutoff date, and then they reassemble. Time-limited groups, if you're doing time-limited groups, need a reset time. And probably all your groups, all your small groups, whatever they are in your church, probably need a reset time. Someone on your church staff or your church council or somebody, preferably other than the pastor, needs to be in charge of supervising all this. Because groups tend to fall apart, they tend to go off on tangents, they tend to not do what they were set up to do. And if no one's in charge of making this stuff work and troubleshooting all the stuff that has to happen, then they may continue but be very low grade and unhelpful, or they may just, oh, we used to do that, you know. So someone has to do this, and you have to be constantly developing new leaders. So I did this group, and I've done it for a year, and we're starting a new group, and I got someone else. And about halfway through the life of this group, my buddy here is going to take over and lead this group because I recruited him to do that, and he's going to see how it's done, and then I'm going to go over here and start something else. And so you have to have a strategy for starting new groups instead of just wearing down the same old people who know how to work with people. We need... The lay spiritual direction thing is what we're going for. Methodism is monasticism for the masses. Yes. You don't have to leave the world to be holy. You can do it and have your day job and your regular life. But you have to have someone who's helping you. And if it's your role to help, you need to have supervision. And so the leaders need to be in covenant with other leaders. Both to avoid self-appointed gurus freelancing, and I've seen those groups develop, but also so you don't beat people up and wear them out and they get discouraged and they don't want anything to do with the church. That's important. And ongoing groups, and you do have some healthy ongoing groups, often choose their own leaders, and that's okay many times. But once again, they need to be connected. It's a Methodist thing. And they need to be accountable so that if they tend to start wandering off, someone can pull them back and say, no, we need to be doing this, and so forth. So, okay, that's my down and dirty on making the program actually happen. And we have been very efficient. We've got all this said in 35 minutes, so we have all this time for you to talk and ask questions and, you know, be helpful to you.
Well, I'll start just for fun. We've been basically trying almost exactly this. I read a book, can't remember which one, one of these various books, I read it and we've tried to put it in play. Well, basically we thought we did a great job. We have what we call blaze groups because we have a fire theme with all of our stuff. Children are sparks, the youth are ignite, so we have a blaze, small groups for adults. And basically what I was afraid would happen seems to have happened, and I'm starting to get feedback that they're just kind of getting bored, and it's kind of stagnant, and they're wondering why they can't study anything, they're wondering why there's no videos, why there's no teaching component. And I'm sold on the model, and I'm sold on the necessity, and I'm wanting to make it work. But basically we're at a point where it's like, okay, well, we're probably going to, at the very least, sort of relaunch and redefine and double down. Maybe we need to adjust some things. But, you know, we started off great. We had like 60 people signed up. We had like a whole bunch of groups. And now we're down to about 4 groups and about 38 people that are still active as we were just finishing year 3. So rather than growing and needing to birth new groups and all the great stuff we were talking about at the beginning, it's kind of like a few groups holding on. And ironically, it's the young moms and the very elderly are the only people left. We started with a very nice swath of every age group. All of our middle-aged folks have basically decided it's a waste of time and stopped coming. But the young moms and the very elderly love it and are still going. So we need to tweak, we need to adjust, and I'm not exactly sure what my question is, except, I don't know, maybe advice? I feel like the model we're into is almost exactly what you were talking about. I took a picture of the screen with the Kemba part, because part of what we tried to build in was having, you know, each group got to pick one service project you want to do. You get out and serve shoulder to shoulder that semester. So each semester, each Ablaze group is supposed to pick something to go out and do together. I don't know if they followed through. I don't know if it happened very well. But I like that idea of the personal and corporate with those 4 things that were listed there. So I took a picture of that. But
that's this book, Covenant Discipleship.
Okay. That's not the one I read. But
Has one on how to develop class leaders.
It's the small group meeting or something like that. It's white with like teal letters on it. I can't remember which one it was, but
David Lowe's Watson used to complain that the United Methodist Board of Discipleship supported 16 small group programs. Because we all thought small groups, qua small groups, would have this immense benefit, and we've offered people a smorgasbord, surely something will work. So, you know, not a lot of confidence that this really does work, sure. And, you know, you keep doing it until it yields fruit.
So I guess my question is, any advice, 1 and 2, just to kind of go a step deeper, where, as we've been directed by the conference, you know, since I'm presiding elder, I feel like I kind of knew these things, we're rethinking our membership expectations, and et cetera. I don't know that we're ready to go all the way to making every active member of the church be in a small group, although I really would like to go there personally. My leadership isn't quite ready for that. I would at very least like to make either a class or a van be a requirement to hold any sort of leadership position in the church. I think I'm ready to advocate for that. How do you see the band and the class relationship working together? Should multiple bands make up a class? Does that matter? Does it work well to have bands apart from classes?
Well, the band is a self-selected group.
So that should be kind of separate apart from the class structure.
Well, they're basically doing what a class meeting would do. You could belong to both, but if you're doing bands, you're doing what the class meeting is doing. You don't have to tell people they have to do.
Like in seminary, I always pictured it as sort of the class was your 12 to 15, and then you would subdivide into groups of 4 or 5, but that makes more sense if you're more of a self-selected.
So let's say you have 6 or so class meetings, and class meetings are not technically cloistered. You could bring a visitor, although be aware, every time a newcomer enters a group, the class resets to 0 in terms of its relationships. And so you have to feel each other out and waste a lot of time. But, you know, if someone's interested in checking it out and you want to bring a new person in for a week to see how it works, you can do that. And likewise, you can add people as during the lifetime of the class. If you have new people move and they want to join in the middle of a class term, it can work, but bands are self-selected and nobody is assigned to a band.
Yeah.
And basically, I hate to say that they get to decide who joins their band, but would you want it any other way?
You can't, yeah.
Yeah, that's a highly restricted kind of thing. It's not better,
but not everybody's ready for that.
Makes sense.
So Art, what I think I heard you saying is that so the classes and the bands are kind of doing the same, it's not curriculum, but the same structure and the questions, just the bands are more intense, is that?
Much more
because
intense.
When you said reunion group, I'm still learning about this, and I thought, when I heard of the bands, I thought, oh, that's like a reunion group from Emmaus, because I got that Emmaus background, but then you said, oh no, the classes are like Emmaus, and so I'm struggling a little bit with the difference.
Well, in a reunion group, we don't say, and what interesting sins have you committed?
Sure, right, okay. So it's always
whereas among the people who are willing to be asked that and respond, that's really close in. Curtis has done this.
I was going to ask, basically, would it be fair to say that the difference is size and intensity?
Yeah.
That would be maybe the...
Yeah, and in the class meeting, it's much more open-ended. So you have the general question, how is it with your soul? Where did you see God at work in this week? And the bands are much more on the sin.
And keep in mind that in early Methodism, and we have lost the steps to this dance, in early Methodism, there was no church. You were all expected to go to the Anglican Church for communion. Didn't work out in practice, but, you know, this was a parachurch movement. So the definition of a Methodist was someone who belonged to a class meeting, which was part of a larger society. And you had to have a ticket to get in. And if you goofed up, you lost your ticket, and you couldn't call yourself Methodist. Or, yeah.
Oh, one more thing. I was intrigued, Phil, by what you were saying at the beginning, just with the work you were doing. And I know, Art, you basically just spoke into this, but Phil, I'd just be interested to hear your take on the translating it to the modern. I know your wheelhouse was how it was originally, but what's come out of some of your doctoral work and research on making it work in the modern day? Are there a couple highlights that come to the top of your mind for us?
Yeah, this is the curse of a D-Med versus a PhD. I have to make it practical. And so I'm working with my church, and the idea, the intent, is we're going to have a small group that meets as a class meeting kind of model, but in an adaptive form. So we'll meet for 8 weeks so I can do the study, and I'm tying in additional spiritual practices, because in our context, we're very used to curriculum-driven kinds of classes, and you know, we have to have some kind of content to talk about. So I'm roping in some themes. I'm also bringing in weekly Eucharist that I can preside over in those meetings. But its foundation is still in the Methodist class meeting. And so the primary content of the discussion is, how is it with your soul? And specifically maybe in relation to these practices that we're bringing in, like the daily Eucharist or the weekly Eucharist, and we'll do a weekly examine, an Ignatian examine, kind of, where did you see God at work in your life this week? Yeah, and so the title of my project is The Class Meeting as an Adapted Model of Spiritual Formation in the Global Methodist Church.
So, we just heard the strategic plan. This boy came over here, culture of call. I've been hearing that loud and clear for 3 years. Been preaching it, teaching it in Fort Wayne. When I think about what you're describing here, and critical, I love it, don't misunderstand, but it also seems like it leads into the critique of churches are really good about taking care of each other. So how can we use this in a way that we can reach the people who will never darken the door of the church, but they're kind of intrigued by Jesus? Or is this something separate to equip the saints to go and do that?
You know, one of the things I love about how the Methodist class meeting started was the only requirement to join was a desire to flee the wrath to come.
Yeah.
As Wesley described it. So just having the desire for God, I think, was enough to be able to join these kinds of groups. And I think we do have records of people being converted in a class meeting setting. So yeah. It changes the dynamic sometimes when you bring somebody from the outside, but it can be evangelistic in a way. But,
and that's where it was to happen, I think, correct? Like, Wesley would do the field preaching, but then they didn't necessarily have altar calls and necessarily doing those things right then and there. He would connect people with class leaders they would go attend a class meeting, and that's where they would repent and have
salvation. Yeah, when Wesley left town, like, he would organize and lead leaders. Yeah.
You didn't have to have a conversion testimony to be a Methodist. You were supposed to be part, you're trying to live the life. And of course, you're going to fail because that's part of the Christian life too. And discovering that you can't do it by yourself, wrestling with receiving the grace of God, getting the counseling where you can understand the assurance of salvation. It takes time for people to percolate all that through to where they're comfortable talking about their faith in Jesus and what it's done for them. And so when I would do confirmation classes, because, you know, when I was I didn't grow up in confirmation. I'm a church orphan. But when I started ministry, the standard model was we got 13 weeks to teach them all about Jesus and everything and how the discipline works and how to be saved. And that was lesson 12. And, you know, bang, and we're done. No, that's not enough time to think about this. Yeah. So my confirmation classes were typically at least 5 months long. And we had lots of things going on, and again and again and again, you come back to the same thing. This is what it means to believe. This is what it means to receive. Okay, the first time they hear that's fine. By the time we get to the end of this class and we've had a retreat and everything else, they have confronted those questions multiple times. And then whatever response they give me, I'll take. If they say they're ready, I don't do this, are you sure business? Because when you're a kid, just translating here, are you sure is the way a parent says, shut up and I'll tell you when it's real. So I never doubt what they tell me. Are you ready to say this to God? Are you ready to say these vows? Are you ready to follow Jesus? And if they say yes, it's like, okay, I'll believe you. I'll take yes for an answer. Now, many of them along the way have had what we would call a conversion experience. That's great. But, you know, and in the class meeting in the early days, you're sitting in this thing and every week you talk about how my soul went and what was up and what was down and yeah, that didn't come out right. And I wish I could feel this. And people are encouraging you and helping you and so forth. And you may be guided through that experience with somebody else. Or you may just settle it on your own because of all the help and love and instruction you're getting informally within a group of people who are also trying to do that. And you've got someone who's watching the process, the class leader. So it's not like we're going to have ask you to accept Jesus because that's a programmatic thing. That's an altar call. We don't do that. But we have people who are trying to do this. And there are people there who've already got all the way through that process and people who are starting the process, and they're all helping each other on to finally get to the point where I can say, I believe in Jesus and I know he has saved me. One of my shticks, by the way, and if you order up my thing on teaching the faith, we talk about the three columns of teaching and learning, because there's three kinds of things we have to teach, and you've heard this, and three ways we have to teach it. There's the acquisition of organized knowledge through didactic teaching. There's the coaching of skills through coaching. And then there's the enlarged understanding of ideas and values through Socratic dialogue and participation in ministry and art and so forth. We stink at coaching spiritual skills. One of the spiritual skills is spiritual direction done by lay people, which is what the class leader is. And so, who can teach people how to be a leader without being a performer?
That is the answer to my question, right there.
And so, that's a whole different thing, and we're not used to it. We love column three, teaching and learning, because we can sit around and gas like a bunch of college students high on caffeine. We'll sit still a little bit for instructional stuff, particularly among kids. You know, this is what it means, this is what the Bible says. Okay, fine. You can't teach people how to pray by preaching a 7-part sermon series on prayer, because didactic means do not teach people skills. You have to pray with them. You have to have someone who knows how to pray and who has the skill to coach a skill for them to learn how to pray or to fast or to lead others or all these things. This is the big deficiency in our church today, is that column two, coaching. And so we're all suffering trying to do these groups, and we don't have the leaders for them, but we don't know how to develop the leaders. That's the critical point. Yeah.
Okay. So you're familiar with my church. Small church. We have one adult Sunday school class. 10 people come faithfully every Sunday. I think it would be a great class situation. But I don't want to take all those people and do that. And you say that the band meetings, that they create their own band. So if you want to create a band or a class meeting from the get-go, how do you do it? Do you put in the bulletin, hey, we want to do this? You have three or four of y'all want to get together and meet each week? Do I have somebody volunteer say they'd like to come, you know, once a week and we'll talk about this? How do you get that out to the congregation? Or do you just go around and say, you, I think you'd be, meet with me on Wednesday.
We started a new youth Sunday school class. Everyone's always starting a new youth Sunday school class because they die. And so after a few weeks, it fell apart, as they tend to do. And the teacher was no longer coming. And when I asked what was going on, she said, I came prepared 3 Sundays in a row and no one stayed for Sunday school. And I'm not going to do all that preparation if people aren't there. Well, what she doesn't understand is the first duty of the teacher is to gather the class. Those narratives where Jesus goes along the lake shore and says, you, come with me. You, leave that and we're going this way. You have to gather the class. That is the teacher's responsibility. Now, we've all been hooked on public school where the state gathers your class for you and puts them in front of you and you're supposed to make something out of that. But in the rest of the real world, if you're going to teach somebody something, the teacher has to gather the class. And that, when I did confirmation, the first thing I did is I sent a personal letter of invitation to every kid I knew who would be eligible. Kids love to receive mail. They got a mail from an important person. I would like you to do this. As well, I would go around and talk to kids individually, including kids in my scout troop that I knew didn't have a church, but were used to running in and out of mine. And I'd say, yeah, we're going to do this thing, and it's going to be 4 or 5 months. You got to come to church and Sunday school. Love to have you do this. You get a medal for it. By the way. And you don't have to join the church, but you will be asked. You know, hands in clear sight at all times. And talk to mom and dad. Hey, they'd like to do that. Okay, well, someone's got to bring them. We'll bring them in. You gather the class first. And then some of them will drop out probably. But that's, you know, if you've got nothing going, you're not going to get anything going by saying, hey, anybody interested in this, girl, come, because they won't. You have to go engage people separately to set up the first one.
How does this fit in because there's not a teaching component curriculum, so then where do you find that, you know, the orthodoxy versus the orthopraxy? Would you expect your congregation to be involved in a class and attend a Sunday school or Bible study or another small group? Or where do they get the biblical teaching and that, if you have a class model?
Well, they can do both. One of the great problems with adult Sunday school is how vacuous it is. What a lot of churches have done is they do children's church, which is basically Sunday school during worship, which is a heresy, by the way. Worship is for all the people of God intergenerationally together. It is not Sunday school. And I have people in big church, oh, we're doing things on their level for worship. Well, I love you, but baloney. You're not. That's not worship, that's Sunday school, or VBS, or call it what you will. It's babysitting so that mom and dad can go have an adult time in worship, and the preacher likes it because kids will call him on his preaching. What do you mean by that? And he doesn't know because he can only say it in big words. Kids are the acid test of your theology. And what we're finding is that the churches that have organized themselves where everybody's apart for boutique kind of experiences, adults do this and kids do that, when the kids grow up, we find that they can't integrate back in and be disciples because what they've been acculturated to do is not what the rest of the church does, and they're not ready for that. So you have to be raised in the faith. So, okay, we're the only church, you're the only country in the world that does adult Sunday school. Nobody else does it. Sunday school's for kids. So how about during the Sunday school hour, you could have some interest group classes for people who want to do topics and things, but you could also have some class meetings running so they don't have to come back a second time in the week to do a meeting. They could do their class meeting with the people they care about under good guidance while their kids are getting the didactic instruction and stuff like that, and do that for adult Sunday school.
So then, but there's not an expectation, as you look at the spiritual formation of each individual in your church, that you want them to have any sort of teaching component. It's only, you know, I guess what my slight concern is, you know, by only having class meetings with, you know, I'm in favor of everything that class meetings does, but where it seems like that could very easily, how do you learn? I mean, we have a lot of adults in our church who are not biblically literate. You know, where do they learn their Bible? You know,
well, you have Bible studies.
Or how do, I mean, I feel like I am not biblically literate in everything. I mean, I'm learning, you know, you watch, listen to Bible Project podcast, you go, holy cow, I have no idea all this is going on. And, you know, you sit there and graduate's great, you know, but
I have Bible
studies. So how do I?
You have retreats. You have special interest groups. No one said you couldn't do adult VBS. I mean, you know.
And everybody comes to Sunday morning, or they should.
In worship, is what you're saying.
And the pastor is the principal teacher of the church.
That's great if you have a pastor, as I do, who is a wonderful teacher. But that's not always the case, so. Okay.
Well, yes.
So that's presiding over
his
job.
In the Ottoman Empire and the Soviet Union, Christians were forbidden to teach their faith.
Yep.
They could worship, but they couldn't teach. And so the liturgy and the preaching taught every generation their faith. And that whole didactic component doesn't need a class. If you're faithful in church and you're doing church right, doesn't need a class. Now, we come from a revivalistic tradition. We think we're selling Jesus by the pound. Oh, you all come to the cross this way. I understand that. That's good stuff. But we need preachers who explain things. And too many of them are doing motivational talks with a religious flavor on top.
Amen.
Yes, sir.
I was going to say for a long time, 4 years back, I was involved in Promise Keepers at a small accountability group. It was just men, and we had specific thing we were talking about. We were all married, talked about, you know, our relationship with our wives, and we talked about pornography and stuff like that. And we're dealing with our own problems, and everything was confidential. And it was a character building experience. It went on for quite a while, but I haven't done that for a long time. I've been involved in a lot of home groups, and our home group format is always some teaching component, but it has a gathering time, an accountability time, an opportunity to get to know each other in the group, and it always then has questions and discussion about how they apply that in their lives, and that's shaping people's character and their faith. And to me, that seems like that dynamic works pretty well, but has for a couple decades.
It depends on how much time people have. Busy people don't have an hour and a half a week, but they might have an hour a week.
Yeah, that's about an hour and a half.
If you only have so much time, what all can you do? What must be done, and what would be nice to do? When I was teaching teacher education students and we were talking about class time, I would say, the size of your truck determines how many vegetables you can take to market in one trip. Do you have a 45-minute period? Do you have a 60-minute period? Is it a 90-minute block? How much of that is gathering time? How much of that is wasted time? You're teaching Sunday school, and it's a 60-minute period, but you spend 15 minutes trying to get everybody in the room, and the parents start showing up 10 minutes early because they got to get to Bob Evans before the Baptists. You know, how much time do you really have, and what are you going to do of most worth in that time? And so the extra stuff, if something's got to go, the accountable stuff has to stay. Because we can fill it up with interesting stuff, but they won't grow. Well, we need to get out of here. Why don't you pray us out, Phil, and we'll go eat.
Sure. Lord God, we thank you for the chance to share in the great tradition that we have inherited as Methodists. Thank you for the people called Methodists. Thank you for this heritage which they have passed on to us today. And Lord, may it bear fruit in our churches, and may we grow in our understanding and our love of you. And we pray this in Christ's name. Amen.